Meditation.
Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening to the podcast. You know, how do you change the world without being a jerk, without being one of those people? You know what I'm talking about. Well, this is the topic of today's talk by Shastri Ethan Nickturn. What is the intersection of meditation and social awareness, social activism, social change? How do you influence the world around you now armed with this greater awareness, greater compassion, the various attributes awarded to you by having a regular meditation practice? Shastri Ethan Nickturn gave this talk a couple weeks ago at our weekly Dharma gathering, and a lot of great dialogue, particularly in the Q&A, about dealing with people who have very different beliefs than you do. I mean, how do you do that? So stick around, it's a good discussion. Visit our website, inmydachambala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. I want to draw your attention particularly to Shambhala Training Weekend 1. It's our introductory meditation weekend. We put it on several times a year. It's happening next, the weekend of March 2nd. That's a Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, half of Sunday. And it's being led by Dr. Shante Smalls, another regular contributor to the podcast. Definitely check out some of her talks if you haven't heard her yet. She's great, and it's going to be a great weekend. So go to the homepage, nydachambala.org, for more information and to register. Again, it's Shambhala Training Weekend 1. Feel human again. And now, here's Shastri Ethan Nickturn.
I've been teaching for 16 or 17 years, so I'll definitely say that this kind of topic used to be the harder one to get people to show up for. There's something about when you work at meditation centers, the sort of marketing aspect of that, in terms of like presenting like what will actually get people here to work with their minds. Traditionally, and I think there's a good reason for this, so I'm not criticizing this at all. Traditionally, what people would really show up for is either a teacher who was well-renowned or they loved, for those of you who know Pema Chodron, that's probably the most famous teacher in our tradition. You could get, you know, I wonder how many people would come if she ever taught the Tuesday Dharma gathering. Be a lot of angry Buddhists up front who waited for 10 hours to get close to Pema. That is sort of the vibe at a Pema Chodron retreat. Unfortunately, she calms the people down eventually, but that's how it starts. People show up for things that are symptomatic, like working with fear or working with stress. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is so well known, or anxiety, or how to love yourself, you know, which is a deeper kind of symptom of something. But the notion of practice being like, it's going to give me something on a personal level that then will make me happier, more fulfilled, more settled, better, although one wonders what that means, is traditionally popular, you know? And so there's a whole view of Buddhist teachings and meditation practice as kind of a very individualistic pursuit that arises from that, right? Like our practice is about us as individuals. Now, I think this is a really good starting point, but it's really important, especially in this tradition, to know that the levels of our experience that are beyond just me, like the interpersonal level of our experience, the social and cultural and collective and societal level of our experience, are totally part of these teachings, right? But when the focus is on sort of self-care, which again is, I think, is the way it has to start on some level, it sometimes creates a bias that taking one's practice outside of me is an optional part of the path. It's like you could do that if you wanted to, you know. And that's part of, I think, the whole propaganda that has created such problems in our system is the notion that participation in a interpersonal space, in a collective space, are kind of optional things to our awakening, right? Or at best, the way a lot of the conversations go that I participate in is like, so if I really become more peaceful and more mature, which I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Like if I become a grown-up, which is basically what Buddhism is. It's like, what if a bunch of grown-ups actually became grown-ups? Able to be present with themselves and present with other people, able to handle being alive. If I did that, then my practice would ripple out and would affect like my family or the people I work with or my society, right? So it would be sort of this offshoot of my personal practice. So again, there's a sense of it being sort of the social level of practice or the path is sort of like secondary to the actual thing that we're doing, which is working on ourselves. And these, I think, again, I want to say that I think there's something very healthy about the self-focus of the teachings and also something very limiting. One of the limitations is that we view social engagement as optional, just the same way voting is somehow optional in a democracy, which doesn't work. You can't have a democracy and have voting be optional. Do we get that now? We could have a totalitarian dictatorship and have voting be optional, very optional. But if we're choosing a democracy, we're already participating. That's the system, right? The other thing that it misses, which I think is related to the self, is this notion that what we experience in our own mind is a reflection of our social spaces, right? This is often like, has anyone ever wondered why there are so many self-critical thoughts in one meditation session? And said, wow, I am a really self-critical person. Perhaps that's because we exist in a society that sends us messages all the time that cause self-critical thought, right? And perhaps society sends those messages in different levels of intensity and different levels of weight, oppressive or dense weight, depending on which kind of body one happens to embody in such a society. Right? Like that, this is the other thing it misses, that we are experiencing our own thoughts in meditation. Nobody else can get into our own mind, but we didn't create these thoughts. They actually neurologically don't know where thoughts come from, but they literally are a reflection of our social space. So we are personally accountable for them. We have to work with them. But if you saw an ad today, and you did, that's influencing your meditation session. It's one of my favorite quotes by Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche when he talks about this other way that the social space, the collective level of our practice, and the interpersonal level of our practice are constantly influencing our self. And he says, I love the words he uses. He says, most of the thoughts we take to be our own are really social ceremonies grafted onto the mind. So that's, right? So in terms of talking about a mindful activist, I think the first of the three principles I wanted to look at is that we really have to take our seat in the world. That's what this path is about. It's participation in society as a practitioner of this path is not optional. This has been really interesting for me. I have somehow developed a reputation as in the sphere of Generation X meditation Buddhist-y teachers. I've developed a reputation for talking about movies a lot. But other than that, I've developed a reputation as being like one of the teachers who's vocal about social engagement, which I find ridiculous because, again, I just feel like I'm doing like the bare minimum for being a citizen of a democratic society. And if I'm going to practice and teach meditation in this particular society, I have to actually participate that way. But I don't know if you've seen this. A lot of my colleagues and friends who are amazing people seem to have some concerns about vocalizing perspectives on certain issues which we decide on the relative level of our experience. And sometimes it's because there's this desire, and I think this is the more loving and smart aspect of this way of thinking, which is a desire to be inclusive. So that if I'm teaching meditation and somebody disagrees with a policy or a thing that I'm involved with, they wouldn't feel excluded from the Buddhist teachings because of the disagreement. That at least makes sense as coming from a compassionate intention. But then there's this other premise, which is it's sort of this. Here's what I wanted to say. There's no Buddhist teaching about neutrality. Neutrality is not a Buddhist teaching. Equanimity is, but that's about how you hold the space for different experiences to arise. Compassion and patience, these are, but they're all actually coming from being a subjective being living in the world in relative reality. So a lot of times I hear this narration of what seems like inclusiveness, but it's actually sort of shirking the responsibility of taking a seat in the world. Right? You hear it all the time, like somebody just says, people just need to listen to each other more. Well, yeah. But now let's apply that statement to different historical situations. And this is going to get uncomfortable for a moment. Jews and Nazis just need to listen to each other more. Slaves and slave owners just need to listen to each other more. The statement stops making sense as any clarified, discerning, or compassionate investigation of reality, which all the Buddhist teachings are based on, right? So listening is a great practice, but you have to actually have a seat at the table to do that. And so I've come to the conclusion that my job as a meditation teacher, Buddhist practitioner, is to actually leave space for people to disagree with me. I know we're in a certain neighborhood, there's a certain demographic here, but I'm sure we disagree with each other more than we think. That's actually the hardest moment, right, when to leave space for and be inclusive of, when you disagree with your people. You're like, wait, I thought we were... right? But to leave space for the disagreement, but also not to remove myself from having a perspective on matters of relative truth. Instead, to narrate how my practice leads me to the perspectives that I have. That's what I think teaching is. You demonstrate your own position as an attempt to express your understanding of the teachings you're trying to follow. Does that make sense? So that's really the first premise. Take your seat. Right? And then, this is related to how we rouse energy in this warrior tradition. The next step is to really feel into the relative truth of whatever conversation we're having. So somebody throw out a relative truth issue that's meaningful to you.
Food stamps.
Thank you. Right. So you would actually investigate this. What is this issue? Right. You would listen to people. You would learn about the issue. You would become mindful of the issue. You might have to listen to people who disagree with you, right? So what is that? What would be, somebody you perceive as disagreeing with you on the matter of food stamps, like what?
Why would my tax money go to support somebody who isn't working?
Right. Why should my tax money go to somebody who isn't working, right? So you actually hold that perspective. Now, here's why I think we're so afraid of listening. And I was co-hosting for this group Sounds True summit on mindfulness and meditation, and I got to host Diane Mushu Hamilton, who did a great job talking about mediating. And I think we are afraid that listening to somebody equals empowering them. In other words, if I listen to your perspective on this matter, it means if, and I get it because we're all so busy, like if you actually read someone's book, I am always like, that's like 6 hours of your life. I am always so, but to listen to somebody, it's giving them power for a moment, right? So there's this fear that like, if I listen, I'm going to agree with you. I use this example from my book because I found out, being a fan of The Princess Bride, that one of the biggest Princess Bride fans in the world, you may have heard me say this, is Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Did you know this? Does amazing impressions of most of the major characters of Princess Bride. So I got to have this amazing conversation with Mandy Patinkin, who wrote an op-ed piece, who's a meditator, when he found out that Ted Cruz was such a big fan of this movie and how much it irritated him, right? So if I were to meet Ted Cruz and just have a conversation about a cultural narrative that we both connected with, by the way, like there are lots of stories out there about how Ted Cruz is an awful human being. I'm not saying that you would disagreements. I'm saying like that his personal manifestation is problematic. There's an article written by his college roommate about what a horrible human he is. Now just feel that, like having meditated, that's feel bad for both of them, right? So if I were to say I'm actually going to sit with Ted Cruz and listen to him and maybe we could use The Princess Bride to connect, does that mean that I'm going to vote for Ted Cruz? No. And it might actually give me insight, I don't know if you've ever listened to Ted Cruz speak, about the strategic manipulations within his expressions. He's an incredibly good manipulator of expression. So listening isn't just about emotional connection, although that's a good start. It also will tell you how somebody's mind works, which if you want to change the world, know how the opposition's mind works. That's what the warrior does. The warrior's not here to let confusion win. Right? Our tradition is not like, this is really important. The Shambhala tradition, when we say warrior, we are talking about nonviolence. We're talking about compassion. But we're not talking about being like the little Buddhist practitioners on the side of the battlefield while the world goes to hell. We're talking about like how actually could a compassionate society beat a confused, selfish society? How could it actually win? So a lot of that comes from listening. And then in terms of feeling into the space, there's also a need to express ourselves. And I think this is really where there's the grown-ups need to be grown-ups. So when we, like, I remember watching last week, and I was so dismayed by it, how many progressive voices were sharing the video of Mr. Donald walking up the tarmac and up the steps and showed the bald spot. As if, what is that? How does that help people get food stamps? Because I don't know if you've noticed how this works, but that's going to be the story on Fox News. These awful progressive people making fun of our president's bald spot. So the right speech here is not about criticizing people, because we believe in people's basic goodness, no matter how habitually removed from it they are. By, if you study the classic Buddhist teachings, perhaps by lifetimes and lifetimes of confusion, to the point where the chances that said person, and you could be just thinking of your boss here, said person is so removed from touching their heart or empathizing with other human beings or seeing their place of privilege or power in the world, that it's probably not going to happen this lifetime, but we still believe in their basic goodness. And we don't really believe that there's a solid self there that's evil and needs to be vilified. We're thinking of actions and behaviors and views in the world, and those should be called out. You know, if somebody is acting harmfully, that should be called out, but it doesn't have to be talking about a person's bald spot. Who cares? And that's actually, I just want to say about Mr. Donald, the way he came to power was getting everybody to not be able to stop talking about him. It's what a narcissist knows how to do. It's like the wisdom. Narcissus' wisdom is, I know, because it's the only way I feel safe in the world, I know how to take my seat, which might be a gold toilet, but I know how to take that seat and draw all of you into my world. So the way to beat that is not to go into the world and say, you're an awful narcissist. That's just empowering the golden toilet more. It's a great analogy for that world. The golden toilet. So then take our seat, feel, and then the third step, and these are from teachings that you can learn as practices later on called wind horse, rousing one's wind horse. The third step is to radiate confidently from your seat that which you want to empower in this world. So I think one of the principles I've been working with recently is the notion of working in the organizations and communities I'm part of, in social media, to attempt to empower voices that don't have a lot of power. Right. There's a principle of amplification. Right. I read this very interesting article once about the Obama administration. I don't know if you saw this article. I believe it was in the New York Times, but about women in the Obama administration. That they noticed, I don't know if anybody here has noticed, that sometimes women's voices are not equally heard. It's a great New Yorker cartoon recently, which talked about more pithily described mansplaining than anything I've ever seen. It's a man and a woman. A friend commented, because the woman looks like she's a little bit in shadow, that it's actually intended to be a white man and a woman of color, which makes this even more powerful. But it's the man talking, because of course. And the heading goes, "Let me interrupt your expertise with my confidence." So the women in the Obama administration saw this happening, and they decided to practice amplifying each other in meetings, right? To radiate from their seat, "I really like what she said. I agree with that." To actually bring voices forward. So this could be another premise that we work with sometimes in some of the embodiment exercises and different ways of actually seeing power in a space, of actually seeing who has a bigger seat. And the premise of stepping up and stepping back. And I just want to say a few more things before I step back. It is really important to view one's path, and these teachings are really all about it, as a balance of the personal, interpersonal, and collective levels of our experience, to see them influencing each other constantly. And sure, I really recommend everybody in this room at some point do a week-long meditation retreat, not even a weekend. But I would, if you haven't done Shambhala training and you're free the weekend of March 2nd to March 4th, Dr. Shantae Smalls, dear friend, colleague, wonderful teacher, is teaching Shambhala training weekend one that weekend. And if you don't have plans already that are important to you, I'll make this statement. There's nothing better you could do with your time than that weekend. If you already have plans, then you've already figured out what is important for you to do. So sure, deep personal practice is important, but the point in this tradition is actually to work on society, including all of the interpersonal relationships which link the personal with the collective. Another great thing the Sakyong has said is, the relationships between any two people are the building blocks of a society, like the Legos that put a society together. So that interpersonal level is incredibly crucial here. So this balance is really what I use to check in with how my practice is going. Sure, you could talk about the deep states of samadhi or meditative absorption if you want to geek out. There's a lot of depth of geekery in meditation that we can talk about. I've studied some of it. Sure, we can talk about how relationships are difficult. And sure, we can talk about politics and social justice. But it's viewing all three of them together that really links the whole path as a balance, as a warrior in the world, which is the sort of ideal of this tradition. So that's it. That's all I have to say.
Hi. In terms of activism and in terms of listening to people that you disagree with, I find something really challenging is that I don't have a lot of trusting relationships with people with whom I deeply disagree. And so how to bridge those gaps? And do we establish relationships with people that we disagree with in fundamental ways? And how do you manage that from a mindful place?
Thank you. Does anyone else want to speak to this? I can speak to it.
I'd love to piggyback off of that, because I have the most rebellious French father I've ever seen in history. He's a Republican. And like and it blows my mind because it's like he ran away from France because of whatever political ideals were going on at that time and married an immigrant here in the States, well, after my mother. And now she's from Mexico and she's pro build the wall. I'm just, it's like mind blowing to talk to them. But like in all that confusion, you know, I have to do a lot of this work, a lot of other outside work to trust them, to trust their guidance, to trust, you know, to know that there's still, you know, compassion in the relationship between father and son and the journey and how hard it is and setting examples in this life. But it's funny because I definitely don't go to those, you know, I don't go to them for advice. Yeah, I carve my own path. So there's a lot of big decisions in my life. Just because that, I think, I guess I fault them for the path that I'm on, and I just accept the path that they're on. And then I have the same relationship with my mother, who's also, you know, polarized with political views. And it's so tricky because it just immediately turns into a raging argument. And it's like, but if for some reason I do listen to her because I feel like I understand her confusion with it all and that she's sort of subject to like the mass hysteria or the advertisement of where politics is today. And I can just sort of see like, you know, I guess I can see her basic goodness. And so, you know, and that's that like mother-son relationship. It's very powerful and kind of haunting. But it's always extremely emotional, what you just brought up. It's never easy for me. And that's about it. Yeah.
Thank you.
I am also fortunate to be from one of the deepest, reddest states in the South. And so everyone who I am intimately close with just about is quite Republican.
Which state is that?
Louisiana.
Yeah, my family's from Arkansas. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I want to say is probably I went to college and no one in my family did, so it was sort of take your college ideas and talk to your college friends about them. And hundreds of versions of that. And so I sort of disassociated from my family. I still visit them twice a year, and my daughter still has a relationship with them. Like, I go back, but we could all be in a room together without fighting in front of our parents, you know, and things like that. But and I kind of got good at it, and then I made some friends in the North. And and about 5 years ago, I took a Awaken the Heart course or something in Philadelphia. And magically, over the last 5 years, I have reestablished a relationship with my sisters and my mom. My father's passed away. And I didn't know, I thought, what happened to, who are these people that are like talking to me now? I totally didn't get it. And only like in a 6-hour drive from Rochester, New York to Philadelphia, which I did every Monday morning, I realized, oh my, maybe I also changed. Maybe this meditation is helping. So I think I'm able to see their worldview in a way that I couldn't before, because maybe I quieted my mind a little bit. It's not very quiet yet, but working on it. And so, yeah, I'm scared to know what's going to happen on our next visit. You know, like, I'm not saying, like, wow, it's happened, but seeing other people's worldview is really interesting, really interesting.
That's true. Next
year. I am a warrior. I'm an impact warrior. Great. I believe in doing well while doing good in the world, and that as an American who's been brainwashed by the notion of profit and business and accounting, you know, that the way we're going to achieve change is through empowering productive companies to stop us from poisoning each other and the planet. And I think that there's, you know, I'm personally mentoring. I have my day job, and then I spend a lot of time mentoring environmentally responsible startup companies for an accelerator and a proof of concept center. And I am an impact investor with an angel group and putting my own money where my mouth is. And when it comes to, you know, when I was flabbergasted when a young woman told me in New York City she didn't believe in evolution. Hmm. She was coming from a religious space. Mm-hmm. And she said she hadn't decided if she believed in it. And I didn't say anything because I didn't know how to respond. Hmm. And I was taking an Uber in Pennsylvania, and the driver said, I can't speak to you anymore because you're one of those liberals and I can't believe anything you say. It's all a lie.
It is, yeah.
And I, you know, it's, I just have to, you know, I'm keeping the focus on myself and trying to do my work. And I like when you talk about being a warrior and that, you know, I really appreciate you're talking about, you know, there's the personal, the interpersonal, and the collective. I that really does resonate. And that you're saying we're all responsible. Mm. We're all responsible. And I think that's, and we all have a role to play, some more, some less. And, you know, it's incumbent upon us to wake up and do something, or else, you know, the poison just spreads. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
I relate to the family conservatives. I find that difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, my brother did not vote for Trump. He lives in Colorado, but he was really, you know, he would not vote for Hillary, and he's, you know, we would have arguments about it, and he's somewhere there's some hatred of women, but I love him, you know, as a brother. Mm. So I don't engage. But it's but this week I was with the in-laws, my son-in-law's family, and they voted for Trump. And I cannot tolerate any woman that voted for Trump. And that's where I draw the line. Like, I can't believe a woman would vote for Trump.
According to exit polls, it was 53% of Caucasian women in the United States voted. So that's a big group to be.
And New Yorkers, you know.
Yeah.
I was on a plane, and these two women, and I said, well, how do you feel now after voting for him? Oh, we still support him. Mm. So I can't engage there. But I think that the work that I do is I don't try to influence someone else mm-hmm. to change. I just work in a resistance group and work with people that will, you know, resist and will vote. And that's all we can do, I think. I don't think you can persuade those people who voted for him are ever going to change.
I'm wondering if anybody wants to speak to how your personal practice relates to your social engagement, whatever form of social engagement you're taking on. Do you want to? I don't want to completely change where you were going, but
I kind of wanted to speak to what you were saying about how it's difficult to engage with people you don't necessarily agree with. And I wish I knew the person's name, but I don't know his name right now. But there is a famous African-American man who's traveling around collecting Ku Klux Klan robes. Mm-hmm. And he's doing so by just... I'm sorry? Yeah. And he's literally doing so just by befriending Ku Klux Klan members, mm-hmm. and you know, sort of connecting with them on a human level. Mm-hmm. I personally am one of those people that during the election did not do a friend sweep, so to speak. I'm a millennial. And I kept around my friends that were still, you know, supporters. I don't agree necessarily with their views, but I can't demonize them for having a different mindset.
What does a friend sweep mean?
Like on, well, sorry, social media, like, you know, during the height of Trump winning the election, there was a lot of turmoil online with friends deleting friends because they didn't vote the same way on both ends of the spectrum.
Gotcha.
For me, I'm not necessarily full Buddhist, but I definitely believe in the middle path and trying to choose a sort of in-between space, so I did not participate in that. And I'm glad that I didn't, because, you know, since then, I do engage with them online, you know, on topics related to this, and I try to get them to see the other side. I know I can't necessarily change their mind, but ideas are like seeds, and they grow. And if you try to communicate with people on a human level and still see them as people beyond the disagreements, they're more likely to listen and grow as well, whether you see it right then or you see it in time. So I definitely encourage everyone to not be afraid to talk to these people. Engage them. And like you said, just listen to them. And a lot of times you'll find there are places where you can find a middle ground.
Thank you. It's interesting that we're talking about, because I do have a few family members who I believe are voted for Mr. Trump. And it's interesting that that's the group that we're focusing on here. It's a lot of pain there. We could focus on talking to friends who we feel are harmed by that, or people who didn't vote, right? People who weren't registered. Yeah, so it's interesting. That's another thing that's in this space about where does our conversation go. So if anybody wants to take this conversation in a completely different direction, as long as we're still talking about the personal, the interpersonal, and the collective, I'm going to invite you to do that, please.
I'm a long-time practitioner, and, you know, this year was really hard to be a good Buddhist, and, you know, the
every
context.
Year is really hard to be a good Buddhist.
So I felt a lot of anger. You know, I'm sitting, I'm breathing. That's my practice, is to breathe, and you're going to take away oxygen. You know, like the government shuts down the EPA, and, you know, the correct, I think in my world, the correct, and you know, my reaction of anger is appropriate in this particular, you know, instance. So you're gonna pollute my water supply, and I will not have clean air. And that's global. So it's not just America. So politics turned very personal. So people, especially in the spiritual world where I work, you know, I work with a lot of healers. I'm a mindfulness teacher, and you know, and people will be like, "Oh, you know, positivity," you know, and I'm so tired of it. So it was liberating to hear you speak truth to matters that matter to all of us globally, not just here. And it's okay to acknowledge pain. You know, pain and pleasure are their sisters. So it's not like it can get really uncomfortable.
I like that, of course, you said sisters rather than brothers.
Yeah, and I'm a tree sister. So for many years, I worked for tree sisters, and we're reforesting the tropics and empowering women at the same time in communities around the world. So that's something we can do as a social, as a personal practice in terms of social activism. But this year, it's intolerable to just breathe with the collective and act like it's okay.
Right.
So being here tonight is liberating. I'm like bursting out of my skin. I'm so happy to be here because I'm happy that you're speaking up.
Great.
Thank you.
There's so much to say, Hilda, to what you said. The one part I want to say is that's another bias that in the spiritual, meditative, good Buddhist, which is a term I like to make fun of quite a lot, community, one of the biases that we're up against is that there are certain emotional responses that are okay, like the spiritual emotions, and there are other emotions that are the bad spiritual emotions, and anger and jealousy go into the, like, if you were a good Buddhist, you don't feel those anymore. And that is completely not the approach of this tradition. There is every single emotion has a certain component of it that's wisdom that can be activated into skillful means. And so there's a certain, we have to, there's a certain bias that's affected the spiritual communities that has a lot to do with, when you read it, about why people with spiritual practices would not get active. That a lot of the biases that come in, you start to say, Now, who made that decision that anger is a bad emotion? Clearly, it can cause a lot of harm if it's not treated like a grown-up. So we have to acknowledge that very deeply. But oh, that's a person who doesn't want people to use their anger to, right? So there's a tactic at play in a lot of our spiritual biases that also may be strategic, right? So that's the other thing to look at, is who made that decision? It's probably somebody who was comfortable with the structure of the way things were, privileged by the structure of the way things were, or at least scared of changing the structure of the way things are. Right? So that's good to look at. Like, what actually stops us from being like, anger is a completely Buddhist emotion? So in the Tibetan tradition, I just want to point out, because there's a lot of weird shrines in the room, that shrine in the back is called the Protector Shrine. And it's a wrathful Tibetan sort of bodhisattva, basically, which is a compassionate being, in this case named Mahakala. And Mahakala represents an energy that we invoke to protect the truth, protect practice. And they're usually depicted with weaponry and with pretty wrathful, like, don't mess with me expressions on their faces. And it's the desire for our individual practice to cut through self-deception. Like, if I'm lying to myself about my practice, Mahakala, who's not really a being, sort of like a super, you know. I know we are, you know, maybe are agnostics or have other spiritual traditions, but anytime Marvel creates a superhero movie, we're ready to go see it. So we do believe in this stuff, let's be honest. Even if you're an atheist, if you're going to see Wonder Woman or Black Panther, you believe in bodhisattvas. And so we say, come cut through the bullshit. Pardon my French. I'm going to be called a bad Buddhist teacher because I just said bullshit into a microphone. Right? And that's a general principle. And so this is a time where it becomes harder to pretend. I think what's happening now, in a way, is a great gift, because a lot of things that were happening at a lower frequency in our society are now just happening out in the open. And it's not dangerous for people like me. It's dangerous for friends of mine. It's dangerous, but it also creates the possibility that if people like me wake up, we could actually see the harm and the suffering that was happening at a lower level and shift it, you know? And so I'm very grateful to this sort of, like, the intolerable times that we're living in. Yeah. Please don't tolerate samsara. Yeah. That's how the cycles of confusion keep going, as they convince you it's just good, comfortable enough. I could change things, but that's going to be a lot of work, a lot of discomfort, a lot of fear. So let's just ride this circle of confusion one more time. You know? And so we're on that personal quest to actually liberate, and we're also on a social quest to see how that causes harm. And the thing that I think is so redeeming right now is you look at the real power holders in society. And I look at that and I say, if those people were happy and content, we would be screwed. But look, people who have amassed so much privilege and power have the biggest golden toilets in the world, which is what being a billionaire is, from my humble perspective. And look at them and say, are you happy? Do you feel connected to yourself and connected to other people? I don't see it for the most part. Maybe a few rare examples. But so I do think there's a situation that's ripe to change. And I do think people who can work with their own mind are going to be what stops that situation from becoming complete chaos. I watched the new Blade Runner movie. When you have a baby like I do, you see movies 6 months later. Did anybody see this movie? I was a big fan of the first book. So gorgeous and so desolate, like so cynical. I was thinking this. Has anybody thought this? Like, if our society does collapse, future archaeologists are going to be like, wow, they made a lot of good movies about the coming collapse of their own society rather than doing something about it. It's going to be, I don't want to be that archaeologist-like fascination, personally. So I think we're on to something. I do think we have to practice. I do think the personal and the interpersonal level are crucial to the social level. But it all fits together. And anger is a friend on that path. Every emotion is a friend, if understood and held in a safe container. And that's what I think practice is really about.
Thank you, Ethan Nickturn. And thank you also to everyone who participated in that Q&A. Very, very enlightening. Visit our website, inmaya.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses, weekend retreats, longer retreats. Hey, this podcast is comprised of talks drawn from our weekly Dharma gathering. Every Tuesday night, we have a weekly gathering to which you are invited. If you are in the New York City area or passing through, come to our Dharma gathering every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. If you're in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Otherwise, keep listening. Tell your friends. Thanks for the support. Later.